You're all very welcome to episode 3, season 4 of PBC Podcast, dear listeners. I'm Stephen Delaney.
And I'm Oisin Tobin.
On this episode, we feature as ever an eclectic and wine-raging mix of topics reflecting both on what goes on here in our school, Presentation Brothers College, and in the wider world. What have we got coming up on the programme, Oisin?
Well, Stephen, Seacht na Gaeilge is celebrated here in Prez every year, and now we're featuring the occasion on the podcast. Also taking place in Prez during March's Arts Week, Emmett Brady spoke to Nora Walsh, arts teacher in the school, about this diverse week of events and how creativity is celebrated in Prez. Lockdown masks, social distancing and 5 kilometre travel limits, it all seems like a distant memory now. But Ben Collin brought fourth year head Peter Scott to discuss COVID, the school experience and its long-term effects.
As well as that, we have another radio drama featuring Tyke O'Connor from fifth year and his players treating us to another dramatic delight. And for our big interview, I spoke to filmmaker and economist Gary Wade, who told me all about his passions for economics and how it has taken him all across the world. A very interesting listen there. All this and more on PBC Podcast.
Let's get it started, Stephen. In our first segment, we have Mr. Mullarky and Sean McBride talking about the importance of celebrating the Irish language and Seacht na Gaeilge alongside some very special music guests. Take it away, Sean.
Fáilte Seacht, Thomas Shola, Mott and Tuisle in Mallorca. Ardúspara, Inistum, Fui Seacht na Gaeilge.
Gormagad Hion. So Seacht na Gaeilge stóca is féile idir na Seacht na Gaeilge a tán ag a buinte seo. Agus céag an éirin sé Seacht na Gaeilge agus gur hosig sé amach. Mar Seacht an tá caicís in isión agus lenin sé raig gudí láile fádrig. Agus I mhúr an féin is úntach an rodé, mar cé lúrin sé gachrod is stóche héin le kultúr agus tangan na Gaeilge, ach níos mó ná sin is stóche agus spregin sé díní an cúpla fachal le lárt, cuminic agus is féidir lo, agus ach go hárathe le ling na caicíse seo. Agus is stóche go, you know, déanin sé íracht an Gaeilge a carcon cín, so sé léhúla stócha agus le gnádíní ní amháin caintóirí dúcha se agus ní amháin fólamóirí Gaeilge ach just gnádíní agus is úntach an rudé sin agus is más féidir le díní is tócha cúpla focal úsáid le ling na caicíse seo is maith an rud is sin is tócha agus bíme géisteach leis an radio gomininic ag tachtisteach ar madan agus go háir ar an radio ar Today FM a bhí sé ag leabhart leis an chuid ar a géisteach leis dan cuid is mó déanann siad son iarracht na cúpla focail a thuairteisteach ar madan an son agus is úntach an rud é sin. So, yeah, so is dócha sin an rud is tábhachtaí in áire go spreagann sé daoine, you know, nachfuil an tanga chu cúpla focail a leabhart agus mar is óld a théin bathe tanga í a leabhart.
An ngearrfá go bhfuil cultúr láidir gaol na sa scoil seo?
Cinnte dearfa tá. Is dócha go mbíonn na múntóirí gaol na dhíir ag caint as gaol le chéile ach níos tábhacht í ná sin agus uaireanta chuirn sé úna orm an méid gaol atá ag na múntóirí eile agus i gcónaí déanann siad iarracht cúpla focal le leabhart leat mar múntóir gaol agus is dócha gur sort cúis bród atá an son agus, you know, chuirn sé glundar ar de crí an méid sin a chluisint agus eiscint go háirithe sa seomar fórna agus taobh amuide sin. Bíonn na scoláirí is dócha i gcónaí ag leacha páirt in imeachtaí Gaeilge sa scoláin seo cosúil leis na diaspóireachtaí Gaeilín agus a rilla. Agus cinnte dearfa tarlaíonn sé sin i rinne bliana agus anois a rí Seacht na Gaeilge beidh glór rudaí idir lámha chu.
Well, úntach na rudaí sin in áíre. Tá sé go d'as a chluisteann go bhfuil go leor cultúr láidir sa scoil seo. Ach inis cad atá dhéanamh a gcuing sa Seacht an seo go Seacht na Gaeilge?
Tá go leor in áíre pleanáilte gan le is evenling Seacht na Gaeilge sa scoil seo agus a gcónaí déan fomid iarracht an tachtain speisialta seo chéalúra. Beg go leor imeachtaí ag tarlú sna rangan ar nóig cosúil le tránna geistena sa rilla. Ach in uasar sin beg imachtí múra ag tarlú timpa na scola chamach cosú le comórtais póstéir a bheg ag tarlú sa céad bhliain agus beg sé sin bunathe ar craif cléthe sin siar na mún a bheith ag tarlú ar an mórt beag seo agus guimis gachra ar an bhuirin sa cléthe sin. In uasar sin, bemid ag taispont scanná an gaelga chuma corrigás an irig, taispont amar an Colleen Kuhn de loch na hidr bliana agus im bliana tamid ag smuíne fuin scanná an Rose agus Frank. Agus comála sin, beg céilí ar siúlagain an tachtin siúcuin don dara bliain.
Well, as even a gachtin a céilí ar nóig. Inis stum ní smó fuin céilí seo?
Yes, so beg an céilí seo ag tórlú sa hala sport hi is stair an dairdín siúcuin. Beg na talí Colleeni ag tacht trasna cuing ó scoil neamh Alavís atá díreach taobhling an sás a chathair. Agus beg an túsal machóin a gwing mar farantí agus an túsamach mahúna tabrónar, agus déine sé job úntach a gónaí chun ord agus agar a chamad ar rudí an son agus beg Dan Kennedy Cayley Bandig tachtisteach chun an ceol a cheint. Agus ag bhainte seo cha mé rá go bhfuil obair na gapal déint ag na múntóirí corpadachais chun na rinkí a bhúna dos na lead sa dara bliain. So, is ócháid fíor speciálta seo gónaí agus déine mi gach bliain agus is úntach an rud agus fuinne na lads ort soltas an céadí a gónaí.
Gurbh míle maith agat a bhaisir, bhí sé sin anna simúil ar fad, agus inis beg ar rán a gwingó a níní chrónín, tám seo agus mór an tanam tair.
Táim seo agus smáir agus sás an nárgan naic an eo, nás go gé bart sin ag an altóir ró bhanathe. Thug sé sugrá thar cáard agus fearmh chum, thógus ar láb is go barach brach ní scar míad bím sé seint ceol. Páirtí ní béla gom Rexfaldi ó Rexfaldi aid éidl daidí. Tá a hálaach san áit is fear a ran maiile seo, i bar an trúá na háíonn seach nach ra. Crithnach dig fás an chóthir leis na cláthacha, smé féhibh don trasan go bhheicigh mé abagé bím se seint ceol. Páirtí ní béla gom Rexfaldi ó Rexfaldi aid éidl daidí. Tá tarthaí ag fás am gharding go sa leachtathe, úla spionán agus cuaí ní dadaige. Siúcra imála le ráth go taiscathe, chun suhas mill seán don bhapas don bhanal tre bím se seint ceol. Páirtí ní béla gom Rexfaldi ó Rexfaldi aid éidl daidí. Si a chéile sin mar an stad van fód bhaisiúil, ag luas gan clíomhán is an páiste ar a heascaracht. Stuck in na lábhas na beorán tí parapraní, í cid atálas ag chrónán don lean a bhín mé se seint ceol. Páirtí ní béla gom Rexfaldi ó Rexfaldi aid éidl daidí. Sé mé chun an nádmhaic chu ghrása de scaparing, sto leanaigh an tásan gan gátar gan aspiring. Nuair dheoca ag lánár a bheir bhaitre fó Josephit, go dógad sé láb sin an nártacha páirithes mis se seint ceol. Páirtí ní béla gom Rexfaldi ó Rexfaldi aid éidl daidí.
Bhí sé sin go gloite ar fad, gurbh míle maith agat as sin arist a níní chrónín, as an éráin álainn sin a chahasa doing. Bin tám seo agus móra. Ach anois beg pí a phlíocht a gwing agus tá Bert Fintoras an gláis an seo gwing, a bhaisir ó Rian agus a bhaisir Mac Mahúna.
So, an fila tauron ha gwing in uf na Sean Riordan, rugog Sean Riordan, an sa e gunte chor chai, rugog e mala vorn e ngailta fuus gri, just cúpla mila mohan vohar, agus kashi quid vohar da heil, an sa e gahar chor chai. Sean daan a tauron ha gwing na coolan ti, da sean teima tan sa na ilu o an seil re liach mas malat, sa naum, Riv na scáthán agus na scáláán ar fad agus bhí ar an filasa úsáidhid as a chuid saolíochta agus is úntach an saol a chroigh sé in san dáin so. So, seo an dáin uinge, cúl an tí le Sean Uri ar dáin. Tá tír na nóg ar cúl an tí, tír áling trí na chéile. Loch ar a chos ag siúlan na slí, gan brógacu na léine, gan bérlacu na gaelan. Ach fásin clocha ar gach drám, sa tírse trína chéile, is láirtar teanga ar chúlan tí, nar hig ein air ach ésop. Is tá sé siút sa chréanis. Tá cearca ón is áil sé cín, is lacharain má héalach, is gair mór dóbh mar náid sa tír, ag drána le ga chéine, is cat ag crún na gréine.
Sa chúna hir tá bang drá bhíl, is unta sé an téalán. Quinlór, búchlí, sean hat a tí, is trompa bál of néta. Is kittil bán mar chéan. Is áuna hagan tín céirí, go néfa trína chéile. Tá gwela col a cúl an tí, is bíd a gír a dérca ar chúl gach tí a dérn. Bualam ve ar chúl a tí, sa dorachocht go dénach. Go vecking áun ar cúrt gialí, a tolavín sin ésap. Is é id a fúcha lénta.
Grav míl amágav a vintóri as an písa a filiachasin, when me sora tanabas, agus tá sílagam gravin an lakdeistata sora tanabas fresin. Agus anish, con derachar leis an cailúra seo, de seacht na gwaelga, beg anini griscol agus Greg Lockheed ag búla púrtu.
Some gorgeous music from our very own Miss O'Driscoll and sixth-year Greg Lockheed there. What an excellent way to start episode 3, Stephen, wouldn't you say?
It really was a sheen, and it only gets better from here. During Arts Week, we sent Emmett Brady to catch up with Miss Nora Walsh, our senior art teacher, where they discussed the promotion of creativity throughout the school and how it is explored in different ways, sculpting, photography, painting, and even a bit of Metallica.
Welcome to the podcast, Miss Walsh. Thank you so much for coming on and talking to us. Just for our listeners at home, could you describe what Art Week in Prez looks like and what it means to the students?
Sure, Emmett, yeah. Well, you know, we have kind of, I suppose, different subjects to do different weeks. We've Seacht na Gaeilge, we have Science Week and so on. So we decided we needed to have an Arts Week to, I suppose, to give students an opportunity to showcase talents that they wouldn't, you know, usually get to show other people. And also to, I suppose, promote the arts in general in terms of, you know, studying art or careers in art or how creativity, I suppose, feeds into your life in general, even if you don't decide to study it. So we have speakers coming in, talking on creative careers, things like architecture, digital media and so on. We have workshops, creative writing, practical workshops. Again, inside the school and out, we went up to the Glucksmann this year now for a workshop connected to the exhibition up there. We have displays of work. We have an arts photo arts competition going on over the last few weeks, which kind of reaches its crescendo during Arts Week, where we, you know, adjudicate the entries. So we have a display of that work and other artwork as well on display. We have readings over the intercom every day, some original work by students, creative writing work. We have staff readings as well. Today, for example, is International Women's Day, so we had Miss Whelan read an original piece of work for that. And we had music this year at lunchtime, which was organised by the prefects over the intercom. So, you know, various, I suppose, arts activities going on in general.
So has there been a lot of student engagement? Would you say the students of Prez take part in Art Week?
Yeah, well, I suppose I do think the students embrace it. I think they, you know, see it as an opportunity to show work that they've made that they wouldn't otherwise have. I suppose some of them are asked to attend talks without volunteering. So I suppose some of them maybe not as interested as others, but at least they're getting the opportunity to learn about things or to, you know, that they wouldn't usually. So I think in general, students rise to the occasion and participate as much as they can in it and enjoy it as well, you know. And I suppose there's part of it is, you know, coming out of the normal, you know, classroom situation and experiencing something focused on the arts for just 1 week in the school year is different, and so it's enjoyable. So yeah, I think they do.
Do you think art is important to young people as a creative outlet?
I think it's absolutely vital, yeah. We had a speaker in yesterday, actually, who just came from a WHO conference in Dublin, which is all about creativity and how creativity, you know, they're doing a lot of scientific studies on it now, how it's very important for personal development and for brain development as well throughout your life. So I think it's really important that students get that opportunity at a young age, because they may be kind of, I suppose, sort of geared towards, you know, or advised towards maybe other subjects for practical reasons or for career opportunities and so on. And maybe they don't get the chance to study the arts like the same as they might academic subjects. So it's important that they, I suppose, participate in the arts outside of the school situation, have those opportunities and are encouraged to express themselves in that way. Because a lot of people kind of, you know, don't express themselves well, maybe academically, but are, you know, very, very kind of expressive and capable and skillful in other areas like music, you know, or visual arts, or, you know, maybe working with materials, or students maybe in TY realizing that they're very good at filmmaking, for example, or doing podcasts like yourselves. Do you know what I mean? So, yeah, I think it's vital that students get the opportunity to experience it and that they hold on to it throughout their lives. That it's not just something that they do in school. And even if they go into a career, you know, as a doctor or, you know, an engineer, that they continue to engage in them, I suppose.
And what drew you towards a career in art?
Sorry, say that again, Emmett.
What drew you towards a career in art?
Oh, what drew me?
Mm-hmm.
what drew me, I suppose, is I was always engaged in drawing, you know, as a child. I loved drawing, and I always drew my family. I like drawing portraits. I still have sketches, and my family still have sketches that I would have done as a very young person of them, you know, sitting watching TV, or, you know, my sister doing the ironing or whatever. And they're really nice to have. But I think I just always, I've good eye-hand coordination, I suppose. And I was always kind of very physical and creative kind of a kid. So I liked, you know, physical things, doing things that way. And then I suppose I was probably influenced, you know, by people I met as well. And I just enjoyed it. And I knew that it was something that I was passionate about and that I wanted to pursue. I didn't think about teaching initially. It was purely the actual doing, you know, of the arts work.
And do you feel like the interest in art has changed over the years, not even just in schools, but just societally? Do you feel like people value them more than they did?
Yeah, I think societal is different to school. I think school is driven a little bit by, you know, there's different kind of influences on choices that people make in terms of subjects, you know, in their lives, in terms of careers and so on. So I think there's a lot more opportunities for subjects as well in schools, and there are a lot more subjects having come into the Leaving Cert curriculum. So I think, you know, definitely it's difficult to sustain, you know, art as a subject, you know, with all the competition that's there in terms of school, but you still have a cohort that will always want to do it regardless, I suppose. But societal then, I think definitely, you know, during the pandemic, there was a huge kind of gravitation towards artistic activities, was because people found themselves with time to maybe be with themselves and their thoughts, and maybe engage in activities. They had more time to engage in activities that they maybe were too busy to engage in previous. And also we kind of realized during the pandemic how important the arts were to our mental health and the survival of that kind of isolated period in our world. I think there's a lot of progress after being made in Ireland, particularly in the film industry. I mean, we can see we've had huge success there, and the government are definitely investing in certain areas, you know, of the arts. But I think that there could be a lot more done in terms of promoting it as a subject for younger people in school, because, you know, there's a lot of emphasis on the STEM subjects. And I don't think that's balanced out at all in terms of the creative subjects within schools coming from the government. I think they're good at talking about how important the arts are, but they don't really put their money where their mouth is in relation to education anyway. They do maybe in other areas, you know, of the arts in society in general.
And how does Prez promote creativity? Like last year I took part in the open mic, and I remember there would be tons of students reading pieces they wrote or playing music that they really, really enjoyed. And are there any other extracurriculars within Prez that you think promote creativity?
Yeah, definitely. I think that open mic thing was great. You know, it really showcased talents, gave students that platform, and it was informal as well. So there was no pressure, you know, you didn't have to do it. Didn't feel you were practicing for weeks for it or anything. It was just, if you want to come up and do it, do it. I think there's is a great creative writing, you know, support here in the school. You have the club, the reading club, the creative writing club. The TY programs are great as well to promote creative activities. You know, we have the photography, we have the film studies.
Even the barista, you could say that's a form of creativity. And
yeah, with the little hearts that you can make on top of the coffee, is it? Yeah, absolutely. And there's theatre production, I think it's coming back in. So I think there's, you know, that Prez does a lot, and they've totally embraced. I mean, school have facilitated, you know, the Arts Week, you know, with the Heart and a Half, and there's so many different things going on. You know, it can be difficult to facilitate everything. But I think we have a strong history of the arts in the school that we need to keep up, you know, going back to some names that come to my mind would be Dan O'Donovan, the English and Irish teacher here, we have our theatre called after Dan O'Donovan, and, you know, there's a great history of theatre in the school. Then we had Mr. Ahern, our great English teacher, who put on those great productions, you know, the plays over the years. And they even had musicals here years ago, seemingly, as well. So, you know, there's a great strong history of it, and we need to keep it up. I think the podcast is fantastic addition as well to the school. You're doing great work. So well done there.
Miss, there's tons of artwork strung up all around the halls of Prez. Could you tell us the stories behind some of them, or maybe the background?
Yeah, I suppose I've had a lot of talented students go through the school over the years. I'm here 23 years now. And, you know, I've always kept work by students. So I decided to, you know, start framing work, you know, a good few years back, I suppose now, just to remember. I always, when I'd look at a painting or a drawing or a piece of work, I'd always remember the student or the face of the student. So, you know, I thought it was important to remember them, I suppose, more formally by actually getting the work framed and putting it up and letting students here and now look back and see the great work. So we have, quite current would be a Cillian Murphy portrait that we did back, I'd say, about 8 years ago, maybe now. And it was a group project by a group of fourth year students, art students in art class. And we decided to do it in a recycling way. So we used cans. Mr. Jordan, our caretaker, used to collect bags of cans, you know. So he provided us with our raw material for it. And we were able to select different colours then from the cans to make an actual portrait of Cillian Murphy. So it's quite big, and that's up in the school. And we did other group portraits as well, where we did paintings of famous photographs, portrait photographs by Steve McCurry. Mm-hmm. One infamous one would be the Afghan girl, which was done by another group of fourth year students. We'd have individual pieces of work then by students that would have been maybe done as part of their exams. So they would be like finished posters. We have a meteorological poster by Mark Merriman, for example. Louis Roberts is a student, very talented student, that springs to my mind, magnificent sculptor and painter, who is a still life piece by him. John Maxwell, we have some still life pieces because we did a lot of still life, I suppose, for exam work and imaginative composition work. And we have beautiful pencil drawings as well by Josh McCarthy and various people like that. So I, you know, I'd be aware of leaving people out. There were so many endless, you know, students with talent that we have work up on the walls by, and they'll always be remembered anyway by me one way or the other, whether they have work up on the walls or not, because of their amazing talent.
And is there any way for our listeners to see any of this artwork or any of the work you're doing with Art Week?
Yeah, well, we would have some work from the archive up on the website already in the gallery, but the work from Arts Week now this week will go up on our app.
Miss Walsh, thank you for all of your continued efforts in the arts and keeping in line with creativity. To celebrate some creativity, we have Alexander McGarry Hernandez making his PBC podcast debut performance with One by Metallica. Thank you.
It's amazing to see the arts and other creative outlets being promoted and celebrated in our school. Some great talks about the arts and a great performance of One by Metallica from none other than Alexander McGarry Hernandez.
Up next, we have the big interview, and I must say, I have really been looking forward to this one. Gary Wade talks about his love for economics, filmmaking, comedy, and much more, as well as all the incredible places these passions have taken him and the opportunities they've given. Stephen, you did this interview.
Yeah, I really, really enjoy this one, and I hope you guys do as well. Hello all, I'm delighted to be back in the interviewer's chair, and sitting across from me is the entrepreneur, economics lecturer, comedian, actor and producer, among other things, Cork's very own Gary Wade. Good morning, Gary. Thank you for taking the time out to come in and talk to us today.
Good morning, Stephen. An absolute joy.
First of all, Gary, let's talk economics, as it has played a big role in your life. You were part of the Irish team for the Economic Olympic Games that took place in Russia a few years ago. How did you become involved in such an event, and how did you find that experience?
A great friend of mine, Donal O'Callaghan, he teaches economics in Christians, and he knew what I was doing above in UCC with economics, and at the time I was running these Leaving Cert Economics boot camps at Bank of Ireland, and he had been in Moscow. He had been in Moscow at the first World Economics Olympiad. And when he was over there, he just said, I'm going to come back here. And when I come back, I'm going to bring Gary Wade with me. You know, we ran, what would you call it, a testing day where students came in and they were tested in UCC and so on. And we ended up with a 4-man team. It was one of the greatest experiences of my life. And I'm really thankful for going out there because, you know, when you're sitting there and you're taking on the Americans and you're taking on the Chinese and the Russian teams, you really witness global economics and levels. I remember a young man, he was 16 and he was American, and he was the main man on the American team at 16. And he got, on the multiple choice roundings, he got 100%. I am telling you, that was a serious exam. You pass that exam around the staff room above in UCC or Trinity College, and I'd like to see how many lecturers get 100 out of 100 on that one. You know, it was really incredible. I'll never forget, we were flying out of St. Petersburg Airport, and I'll never forget when we were leaving, you know, we got on the bus and we were going back to the airport, and Steve, they were bawling their eyes out. This was their year. You know, they had 8 days of like a visit from the outside world. I got the feeling they felt quite, you know, what's the word? I'm looking for kind of downtrodden and kind of, there's a lot of them, a lot of people I met there felt kind of trapped there. And this was their kind of psychological escape for like a week and a half, you know, 8 days. Dealing with us and dealing with an event that was so exciting and so busy, and we were going all the time, you know, and they lined up outside our bus when we were leaving and they were bawling their eyes out. Grown adults, it was, you know, beautiful people, absolutely.
It's very interesting there just to hear the memories that opportunity now you'll have for the rest of your life. It's some amazing memories. And you've been travelling more recent than that though, haven't you? Can you tell us a little bit about your stay in Gambia last year, and how would you compare it to the time in St. Petersburg?
Oh, that's another brilliant question. Yeah, that was a joy to be a part of. February last year, I went to Africa. I was asked to get involved in a charity project. The charity project involved building a school and teaching the young people their economics. It's amazing talking to you here. A lot of the topics you're mentioning are quite emotional, actually. It's very important to learn about yourself in these situations, you know, from growing up in, you know, Western Europe, being so accustomed and it becoming so normalized that when you engage with someone that they want something from you. And I never realized how acute that was in my mind until I went to Africa. And to give you, what I mean by that is, when I would be approached by people in Gambia, I just assumed they were looking for something. So at this, the first, say, 3 days I'm there, 2 days, when they'd approach me, like, what are they looking for now, et cetera, et cetera. Do you get what I mean?
Yeah.
And then after a while, I was like, it just dawned on me, all they want to do is chat, see how you're doing, see if you're having a nice day, tell you about their day. And it was just an absolutely mind-blowing exposure to the beauty of the African human condition. The beautiful people. They call it the Smiling Coast, Gambia. People would walk across the road, like in between cars, to talk to you and ask you how your day was. And then when we went from there, went into the school, you also realise how fortunate you are. I mean, this is true. I mean, I nearly broke down in the classroom when this happened. So we'd been building the schools for a couple of days, and it was an incredible experience. And the place is beautiful, and it is out of a movie. Like, Africa is, oh my God, it's like God's garden. It's something unbelievable. You go in there every day, like the ocean was turquoise, you know, that kind of image off a movie. It was just incredible. But anyway, we're in and about that kind of thing for a number of days. And then I get asked into the school because the school is taking shape and I'm going to teach the students. So I walk into the class and I thought, oh, there must be a mistake here, because I'm teaching like the equivalent of what would be a junior cert class in Ireland. That's the class I'm meant to be teaching in Africa. But I walk in and they're all children, you know. So I'm thinking, oh God, I'm after walking to the wrong room. So I just asked, they could speak English, so I just asked them, you know, their name or whatever. Just, I think it was just making conversation. And when they told me their name, I asked them what age they were. And they said 15. And I was like, what? They were 15. And as a result of a lack of nutrition in that area, all of, you know, they're undernourished. And physically, they're underdeveloped. And I just stood at the top of the room. Like, there's a picture of me online on the Cork School of Economics website, and all the kids are with me. And when you look at that picture, I defy anyone to look at those children and think that they're that age. You know, it's incredible. But they were remarkable people, you know, and it's just such an unbelievable thing. I think your goal, it's an unbelievable goal in life if you try to change people's lives. And a lot of these people involved in that Africa trip were trying to change people's lives.
And a final question on economics. Mm. What is your advice to those listening who would like to pursue a career in economics?
So what I would say to any young person studying it is, realise that it's not your fault if you're struggling with it. And maybe what you need to do is find a great teacher or find a great source of information online where these things are broken down simply. Because economics is remarkably simple.
For our listeners who don't know, you are a writer and director of the short film Standing Up, which can be found on YouTube under Old Team Productions channel. Personally, I'm a big fan of the film myself, but for those who haven't seen it, can you tell us about it and where such an original idea came from?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, thanks for the question. Where that came about was, and I spoke about this on the Two Norris podcast when I had the pleasure of sitting in with them. I was in UL one day and I always wanted to do stand-up comedy. I always wanted to do it. I was always intrigued by that art form. And I suppose I grew up, a lot of funny people in my family. My friends were all funny. I loved having a laugh, you know. But I was in UL. And I remember walking through the campus one day and seeing a sign outside one of the bars saying there was I think it was an open mic night for comedy or something like that. And I remember thinking, I'd love to do that. But what did I do? I based the decision in fear where I didn't do it. And I walked away from it. And honestly, walking home, this idea for a TV show had come into my head. I had just written my first screenplay for a movie, I think the year before. And I just had this idea. I'd based the screenplay in America. And I was saying the next thing I write, TV series, movie, will be based in Cork. And out of that fear response and not doing comedy, I said, what if there was a guy who was a gifted comedian and was riddled with extreme anxiety? I just thought it would be a really interesting place to start for a character. And from there, the character developed. As I said on that other podcast, I named him Barry Colin. And I lived with him in my head for a long time. The following day, I started writing it, the initial parts of it. But I lived with that character in my head for a long time. And something never sat right with me. I wanted a real legitimate basis for his anxiety. I didn't want him to be just anxious or, you know, something kind of, you know, fleeting, like a one-off incident happened when he was younger. And I didn't want that. And one day, you know, at the end of class, so many students would come up to me down through the years, and I just noticed the amount of students, like to this day, there's not a week goes by when I don't teach students who are dealing with dyslexia and the associated anxiety that goes with that in the education system. So I said to myself, oh my God, Barry Collins dyslexic and he's a genius and he can't read. And I said, no, we're going to make a show of this. And from there, it was madness. That show, it just took over my life. And there's things about that show that I've never spoken about. What I've learned a lot about myself in lockdown and down through the past few years is I've a fascination with escape. I think it's why I was a decent hurler. It used to give me peace, the practice. I used to escape by just practicing. When I wrote Standing Up, I was going through a very tough time personally that we can speak about on another show. And it was the greatest escape I ever experienced, that show. I used to just write it. When things got bad, I would just leave this earth and go there and write it. That is the truth. And the two parts of the character, the main character in it is Barry Colin, dyslexic and struggles a lot with anxiety and different things. And the other main character is Desi Reardon, who I play. And there is without question a big part of Desi in me, and there's a big part of Barry in me, you know. And that show, it was a joy to be involved with. It was incredibly stressful at times, but it was incredibly exhilarating. And I met people and ended up in scenarios and situations which were unimaginable. You know, I remember being down in Jeremy Irons' castle on New Year's Eve, like sat with Neil Jordan and all these people. That sounds very name droppy, but it's not a name drop. It was just, I remember thinking, how did I end up here? And it was just very surreal time. You know, Jeremy Irons, Oscar winning actor. He's the guy who played Scar in Lion King. You know, that famous voice of his. I do a good impression of him when I'm not on mic, actually. but he was Rob Halen's best friend. Rob Halen is a BAFTA winning writer who became my writing partner. So I ended up in that world. And that's, so Standing Up became a show about, you know, a dyslexic wannabe comedian who suffered from extreme anxiety. And I signed a TV deal, a development deal, to make that show. Moved into offices below in Blackrock. Well, you know, a writing room, and to set all that up where I met your dad, actually. And all excitement, great times, full barrels ahead. It was an international TV development deal. The show was going to screen primarily in North America. And away we go. All great. And then one Friday, I got a phone call from the head of the Republic of Ireland, Brian Hurley, lovely guy, actually. And he said, Gary, can you talk? And I can always talk, as you've noticed. Mm. But when a fella asks you that, oh my God, what's coming here? And he just said, it's over. there was a, you know, without going into probably speaking about things maybe that I shouldn't speak about, but it was over, right? Financially, there was issues and the deal fell through. That was it. And yeah, from there then, it was over. And I think it was in Tenerife the following week with my family. And I said, I remember being in Tenerife, sitting down at a table and just coming up with the idea for the Cork School of Economics. I had been lecturing economics with Edinburgh Business School, and I handed in my notice to do the TV show. And I was like, I'm not going back. I'm not putting together my CV and handing it into all these places. I just don't want to. So what am I going to do? And I said, I'll open the Cork School of Economics. And I was in Tenerife and I put it together on a napkin. My son sat beside me drinking an orange juice. I said, when I go home, I'm going to tackle that. But the TV series then was done. It was over. And it, just trying to piece it back together now in my head, it wouldn't leave me alone though. And the reason it wouldn't leave me alone is I actually felt it was really good. I felt it was something. And we went away and said, we're going to film it ourselves. We're going to take it out to Cannes, to the international television market, and pitch it to the world. And that's exactly what we did. And I'm really proud of it that I did that. You know, I think as Irish people, we'd be so hard on ourselves and we never, you know, I've learned a lot about myself, particularly in lockdown, you know, shockingly hard critic of myself, a very bad friend to myself at times. I think we have that in us as Irish people, but I'm really proud of that because I went out there with Brian Hurley, we filmed it and we pitched it. And out there, we got 25% of the funding. And we had another 26% at home. And that was the hard part, because getting the first money is the hard part, because everyone will just follow.
Yeah,
they will follow. But I came home and I was broken. I was down in Dunleary in a post-production house and I had just taken too much on. You know, there was real burnout stuff going on here. I remember one day, this is true as God, I was sitting in Promenade Production House in Dunleary and I was looking out at the ocean and honestly, there was like birds on the sand. And I remember thinking, I'd love to be them, just out there and free of all this pressure and expectation and burnout and exhaustion. So I walked away from it and I walked away from everything. And it was never going to happen. It was never, ever going to happen, ever. And then lockdown happened. When lockdown occurred, all the kind of bribing of my subconscious where I had said, you know, oh, that show, just leave it, it'll go away, it won't bother you, just put it in the back burner, don't do anything with it, la la la, that'll go away. When COVID came, I'd nowhere to escape. And we'd filmed the show, which I felt was a special show. And a lot of people do seem to think it is a special show. And it was over. It was on the hard drives, and I remember, I think I said this to the two Norris, but there was a red piece of tape on the hard drive, and it was just catching my eye all the time. I could nearly hear that hard drive calling me, like, Gary, you never finish, you know. And yeah, eventually I moved that hard drive over by my bed to annoy me further, to just motivate me. And then I said, then that one year, you know, as that year came to a conclusion at Christmas, I said, come January, I'm doing standing up. I'm going to get at it. And then I sat down on January 4th and I sat down and began the edit. I began the edit and the post-production and writing all the music for it and putting it together. And it, with the exception of my son, it's the thing I'm proudest of in my whole life. I really am. Because I just wanted to do it. And, you know, we got it together in the end.
As you've just mentioned there, you play a big role in the film as Barry's best friends, best friend. But did you ever find it difficult to juggle the directing and acting together?
Yeah, I did. I did, to be honest with you. It was very challenging directing and, you know, acting at the same time. Yeah, it's when you there's a mate of mine in Dublin, and he's a cinematographer and director, and he always says, you know, when you make a movie, it takes off 5 or 6 years at the end of your life. Do you know? It's you are playing God as director. Like, every single decision goes through you. From, you know, Neve's in this scene, no, Gary, what colour should her jacket be? To, you know, we're driving here into this scene, should the car reverse into the picture or should we drive out frontward? Every single thing is you. And you're constantly trying to get the best performance out of everyone, and then you're trying to get the best performance out of yourself. And it's very difficult because you're on camera, and you run a scene, and then you have to run across to the control booth and watch it on playback. Whereas there's nothing like, I mean, there's a scene at the start of that show when Barry is in a room with his counsellor, and I just love that scene, and I loved making it. I was in that was shot in a room in Lee Valley Golf and Country Club, and you know, we really are indebted to them, actually. They were brilliant, Dave Cohan and the lads out there. But it was shot in one room, which was really beautifully laid out. And it is a stunning room, right? The counsellor's room. And I was in this other room, all on my own, just with a screen, headphones, just watching this world coming to life. It's just those moments are moments, honestly, just for me, that are worth living for. And then you get to work with such gifted people, Ger Carney and Niall Murphy, in that particular scene, and you walk into the room and you tweak their performance, and you come back in and you watch the world change as you've requested. Incredible. So I absolutely love that. Then when it came to you, because I had a very big part in it.
Yeah.
Acting part, when it came to your performance, then what was really difficult was my character is so hard energy, is so high energy. So if you look at any of the, it was all film behind the scenes, you know, and any of the footage you see me before takes, I'm jumping up and down in the air because you're just trying to get into that place. Because my character Desi Reardon, and it was a joy to play him, but I mean, he is a rogue, and he's always up. He's always up, and I wanted him to be always up because Barry often tended to be down. Barry was often very down because of his natural disposition and personal inclination, but also he's a little bit down because Desi's a big shadow to be around. You know, that's a very big presence. It's a very dominant. That's a very dominant presence, and that was really challenging, to be honest. I was never asked that before, actually. Yeah, that was really challenging. It was, yeah.
It's very interesting, actually, to hear you talk about, you know, the balance in between. And just finding out to move on to the Edinburgh Festival, because as well as an economic lecturer and an actor and director, you also enjoy stand-up comedy, and you've taken part in none other than the world-renowned Edinburgh Festival.
Mm.
For those who may not know, the Edinburgh Festival is one of the greatest celebrations of arts and culture on the planet, which takes place every August in Edinburgh, Scotland. Where does your drive for comedy come from, and has it always been a passion of yours to make people laugh?
Wow, Steve. Oh my God, wow. Brilliant question. Yeah. Has it always been a passion of mine to make people laugh? Do you know, I suppose just because, I'm probably telling you things here today that I wouldn't normally speak about, it's because we obviously know each other and so on. I probably learned when I was 15, I had a very tough teens. I found growing up is really tough. And I found growing up in my teenage years difficult. And I learned when I was about 15 that if you were, you know, funny, and if you took the piss out of yourself, it invariably led to popularity. So there was definitely an element of that. You know, everybody likes a funny person. Everybody likes someone who takes the piss out of themselves and so on. But I suppose I always loved making people laugh. I did. My family, you know, there was very funny people in my family. You know, both of my parents have a brilliant sense of humour. There's no doubt about it. All of my mates, I grew up in the back village of Douglas, where there are incredibly funny people. I was just always drawn to it. You know, my son, who's 20 now, I mean, making him laugh when he was small would just make my year. Really, I was all I ever wanted to do was just make him laugh. And
very honest.
What?
It's very honest.
Yeah, and I just, I loved that. So I was always kind of drawn to that. Then with regard to the Fringe in Edinburgh Festival, like, I'm just going to be really honest here. All of these things, I feel so grateful for having done them. But they are all as part of a kind of personal war that I wage on regrets. I don't want any of them. I don't want any regrets. I don't want to die or be dying and think I should have done that. I could have done that. I wish I had done this. That is it. With Edinburgh Fringe, I always dreamed of being a part of that comedy festival. Honestly, I never thought it would have been possible, but I always would have thought, imagine to go over to the Fringe Festival, the greatest comedy festival on earth, and step up on stage and just go for it. And then the year before last, I was chatting to a friend of mine and we were going to go there. I said, we'll go and we'll just have a look at it. And she said to me, I said, so we'll go have a look at it and then next year I might, you know, take part. And then she said, if you're going there, just do it. And it just, I couldn't unthink that then once it was put in my head. And I was lucky enough to know a few people and make a few calls and this and that. And I got put up on stage at a massive gig over there. It's so annoying. The name of that venue has gone out of my head now. Oh, but it was, anyway, I might come to you in a second. But it was packed. It was like 100, 200 people inside there. Really famous venue, which I can't remember the name of. I went in and I remember again thinking, whoa, Gary, what have I got into here? Like, this is big boy stuff. And I remember sitting in the green room waiting to go on and the other comedians were going up and the other comedians were going on and just like terrified. You know, come here, I'll be honest, I was terrified. And then I was called out. I walked up on stage. I took the piss out of a lad in the crowd who I knew was good crack because he'd been joking with the crowd earlier. They all kind of laughed. And I just told a quick bit where I took the piss out of myself. And then I told what I just thought was a really funny story that happened to me with the Scottish a couple of years back. And I said, they'll either get a fierce laugh out of this or they'll murder me. But again, it was just trying to be courageous and saying, just say it, just do it, just go it. And, you know, as well, committing, you know what I mean? Like committing to the joke, like telling the story, not going up there and racing through it, just taking your time and committing to the joke. And what you learn over there too is remarkable. People should never, ever underestimate the power of a bottle of water. Like, honestly, in my lecturing career in economics, if you walk into a room of 500 people, you look them all dead in the eye and take a drink of a bottle of water, they know you're serious. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah.
It's a big signal. Same in Edinburgh. When you're on stage, you're halfway through a joke and you stop and take a drink of a bottle of water. Let's say you get to a mild punchline. It's not the big punchline, but it's a mild punchline. And just as you say it, you smile and take a drink of water. They go, wow. This is something.
He knows what he's doing. He's serious.
He knows what he's doing, even though I didn't. But it's little things like that and things that you'd speak about with comedians backstage and afterwards. You'd kind of go, whoa. And the links between performance in economics and performance in comedy, there was a huge crossover between the two. Because a lot of lecturers, a lot of teachers don't realize that it is a performance. That's the thing, you know. And I'm private education now, so if my performance isn't strong, I don't get paid.
Would you say that it was the thrill of being up on stage that helped, you know, kind of calm the nerves, or were the nerves almost moving you on and encouraging you to perform very, very well, really?
Yeah, well, that's really interesting. I suppose what we have to realise with adrenaline and pre-match nerves is our body is getting into the place where it needs to be. And if you view it as a sharpening of the human condition that, oh, no, I'm nervous and all this adrenaline is going, if you accept, right, I'll be sharper as a result of that, you go into a positive space as opposed to going, oh my God, I'm terrified, I'm going to disgrace myself and I'll be ran out of Edinburgh. You know, it's a lot of it is about your own vantage point. Like a friend of mine came into me in the venue just before I went on stage for the first time, and she was like, the same friend who had been speaking to me on the phone, she was like, oh my God, this place is big. And she was like, you know, are you dreading and nervous or whatever? And I said, I am nervous, yeah, but I mean, what is the worst that can happen? I mean, what is the worst that can happen? They won't laugh. It's fine. That's all right. You know what I mean? That's all right. Like, I'm a big boy at this point. And I mean, we can live with that if they don't laugh. Like, I remember when I started lecturing and I was, you know, lecturing above in UL. And I remember at every Thursday morning, 11 o'clock, I was teaching, I think it was International Monetary Policy and Financial Economics. And half that class were older, not half the class, a lot of that class were older than me, you know. And there was, you know, the other half of the class are kind of around my age. And I'm telling you, I am so exposed in that room because I'm, what age am I, 22, 23? And I'm inside this room with a really highly intelligent group. And you're thinking, any minute now, they're going to ask me a question that I have no clue about. It was terrifying. And every week, my week used to end mentally at 12 o'clock on the Thursday. Because if I got through that hour without dying, I would kind of feel that I could survive. I could kind of get to, through to my weekend, you know. So the point I'm making is, I knew that no one in the Edinburgh crowd was going to put up their hand and ask about, you know, fucking quantitative easing with reference to the Federal Reserve in United States and catch me out in a question. Yeah, they wouldn't laugh, fair enough. If they don't, they don't. But they did. It was incredible. But another thing, can I just say one thing, actually? In those 3 days, I think I did 5 shows or something like that. And it is remarkable when you push yourself where your brain can go to. By the last show, I was shocked at, like, someone would shout something in the crowd and I'd just say something back and I didn't even realise that I had done it, because you just activated that part of your mind. And I find the same in music now. I'm recording a lot of music at the moment and that part of my mind is really activated. So it's about opening up yourself and pushing yourself, because, you know, you can be capable of decent things.
Do you think that all of this, you know, your life with economics, Russia, Gambia, standing up, and as you just said now, the Edinburgh Festival, do you think this would have surprised your transition yourself? Or were you always fearless when it came to facing new challenges and taking on opportunities?
Would it have surprised me when?
When you were like me, like myself now in transition year, or, you know, were you always the type of person to face the opportunities and challenges head on?
Wow, brilliant question again. Back then, you know, what I really tried to tell my students is you are capable of remarkable things. I really do say that to them. You know, it's so easy to brand yourself. It's so easy for me to walk into a lecture hall and portray myself as a genius. The reason it's so easy is because economics can be so technical and can be so difficult, it is very easy to make it look incredibly difficult and portray yourself accordingly. Oh, look at this, look at this. So people can look at you from a vantage point and go, God, I would never be able to do that. I would never be able to achieve that. And what I always try to tell them, I mean, I'm from the back village of Douglas. You know, I went to Douglas Comm. I was always in trouble in school, you know, and anyone can be anything if they want to be and if they go into it with the right approach, you know. And I really try to get that across to my students, that you can do whatever you like because you just have one shot at this. And, you know, I'm actually proud of myself these days, and I wouldn't have been when I was younger. And I found growing up very tough, and I found Douglas Calm, myself and Douglas Calm, I would have given myself a hard time if I even probably thought about doing anything like that. But there's another thing then as well, you know, maybe it's because I'm the middle child or whatever. I always felt that I was kind of, I found this kind of strength in myself that I will, you know, this sounds mad, but I was kind of like, you know, I'll be there for you. Like, you know, does that sound crazy? You know, do you get what I'm...
I understand what you're coming from, yeah.
I don't even know how to articulate that, but it's like, you know, just do it, just do it, just go do it. And I think this is hugely important. It's hugely important not to base decisions in fear, you know. It's every single scenario is laden with fear if you let it. But you have to just, you know, that old expression, face the fear, do it anyway. Like coming in here today, you can make such a fool of yourself, do you know? You can talk about this and sound like an idiot and be driving home in the car going, God, did I say that really? You know? But just do it. Just do it. Really, you know? I was nervous going to Russia. You know, I was nervous going there. You know, going to Africa, you're nervous. You know, all of those things. But you do them. I'm sure Roy Keane was nervous before going out into Old Trafford. You know what I mean? You still do it. You have to back yourself. A lot of cliches there, but do you know what I mean?
I really do understand.
Yeah. Because you... Look, come here. I have to be honest with you. Like, I've never spoken really too much about this as well. But life is so fleeting. You know? Life is so fleeting, and I've always been hugely cognizant of time and the fact that it is moving by, and it is moving by really quickly, you know, and the people you love will pass away, and that, you know, you're seeing that life is moving forward, and if you don't do things that you love and are passionate about, what are you here for? You know, you can't get to a situation. I can't let myself get to a situation where, you know, my days are becoming numbered and I go, God, I always wanted to make a TV show. I always wanted to write a book. I always wanted to write a song, etc., etc. So, yeah, that's really it. I think it's vital to do what you would love to do. You know, I view, like, COVID had so many benefits, had so many tough times, but it had so many benefits. It made me pull up the handbrake on my life and think, what life are you living here? Like, Steve, it was madness, my life as well, you know, in the lead into COVID. It was 5:30 in the morning, working till 11 at night. And in those brief moments where you'd pause for breath, you'd say, well, what am I doing this for? You know, it was just economics. And now I use economics and my work and obviously source of income to fund, honestly, dreams. That's what they are. I've always had a dream to write a solo album, you know, and that's what I'm doing at the moment. So all finances are to pay to keep me alive. And then I, you know, when I'm not lecturing, I'm at the piano or at the guitar or recording. That's really, you know, because I would torture myself if I went to a place where I didn't do these things that I kind of, you know, planned upon. Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah. Gary, you are a prime example of how anyone can achieve their dreams with enough dedication, and I'm sure that you will accomplish a lot more in the future. Thank you very much for coming into us today, and we wish you all the best.
Thanks so much, Steve. It was an absolute joy. Thank you very much.
Well, Stephen, that interview certainly did not disappoint.
Yeah, I could have spoken to Gary all day, but we have a show to present.
That we do. A huge thanks to Gary for coming in to share his stories and future plans with us. As Gary mentioned, he saw COVID as an opportunity to tackle his filmmaking desires. But we know it also greatly affected this school and all of us in many different ways.
Ben Collin and Mr. Peter Scott discussed the short-term and long-term impacts of COVID-19 on the students here in Prez and throughout the world.
Hello and welcome to today's episode of PBC Podcast. Today I'm joined by our fourth year yearhead, Mr. Scott. The two of us today will be discussing perhaps a not-so-distant memory to you, and that's none other than the COVID-19 pandemic. This was a topic that dominated our lives at the time. For me, my sixth class was cut short on the 12th of March, 2020. And the months that followed, we began an ongoing chapter in our lives. Welcome to the podcast, sir.
Thanks, Ben. Lovely to be here.
Yeah, thanks for joining us today. You know, the funny thing about COVID is that kind of screwed people's perceptions of time. You know, it wasn't that long ago. But for me, it could have been a decade ago. Yeah, even so, I can still recall it pretty vividly. You know, I suppose when I first would have heard about the whole pandemic, wouldn't have been through news headlines or social media or anything like that. I wouldn't have paid too much attention to anything like that at the time. Would have been more, I suppose, through kind of conversations I would have had with friends of mine at Yard, you know? And when I first heard about it, I remember my classmates were like, oh my God, we're all screwed. And I was thinking, this whole thing is definitely going to be a hoax or something. Well, not a hoax, but maybe I just thought everyone was overreacting. And then when it really did happen, when we did close down the schools, I remember thinking, oh my God, they were right. But then I suppose within the first few months, I kind of made the most of it, you know. I'm not sure if I enjoyed the experience, but I just tried to embrace it, I guess. Then maybe midway, I got kind of bored, really. But talking to a lot of my friends, they seem to really enjoy all the time off school. Do you think, sir, that maybe it was more the adults who were worrying about this whole pandemic, that the kids adapted faster? Like, what do you think?
Well, I think that school is probably one of the most unnatural states that anybody has to go through in their lives. And I think that it's sort of interesting that you should say you sort of enjoyed it up to the point that you got bored. School is really difficult, you know, and that discipline of being up every morning and coming in every day and having to be somewhere. And fundamentally a place that a lot of people don't like, or at least don't enjoy, and they could think of better things to do with their time. So I can fully understand why it might have been sort of a nicer prospect for a teenager to sort of pick and choose what they did, when they did it, without having anybody standing over them. From my perspective as an adult, it was an extraordinary time. It was incredible to be sort of part of a living history story. Do you know, you sort of learned it in school, what happened in the 40s, what happened in the 20s, the Great Wars, back to the famine, and to think that they'd be reading about our experience for the next 50 years and how the world reacted and how the world responded. I thought that was extraordinary, but it was an incredibly difficult and challenging time, I would say, as an adult, deeply frustrating. You were questioning everything. As you said, not a hoax, but the response of the country after the initial one, you're sort of doubting whether we've gone too far, whether we haven't gone far enough. And quite a confusing time and stressful, as you say. Particularly, you know, you have kids and you're wondering about their own development, and has that been hindered, and has an experience been taken away from them that they'll never get back? And then, of course, the work side of it as well was, you know, from a teaching point of view, it was difficult. I won't lie about that. It was extraordinary to have to sort of reinvent yourself and take yourself down a path that you hadn't been down before. And it was deeply challenging. A lot of us had to learn new skills and learn them very, very quickly. And it was a hell of a lot of work went into it, like an extraordinary amount of work behind the scenes to sort of keep the show on the road. And it wasn't really on the road at all, because as you say, like, you were doing what you wanted to do, partially enjoying it. I was talking to an empty screen, not knowing were you there or not. And yeah, you put the whole thing together. Sorry, that's just a sort of a mesh of thoughts all coming out. But it's a deeply emotive issue, the whole COVID pandemic. Like,
there was no protocol for it. It was obviously hard to adapt. How did you adapt, really?
Well, I think the school fundamentally did quite a good job. The first thing that the school did was we sort of decided, obviously, the exam classes, there was no clear sort of indication of what was going to happen. You expected the school to reopen next month, the month after, next week, the week after. And therefore, like, you still had your junior cert. You, all of school was important, but your junior cert and your sort of life-defining leaving cert still had to be prepared for. And how do you deliver that when you're not trained to deliver it through the methodologies that are available? Or do you even have the methodologies of technology? So the school quickly adapted and changed from our 40-minute timetabling to an hour timetabling program, which actually had a huge impact on our ability to deliver a better message to particularly our exam classes. And it also took pressure off teachers because it meant you weren't getting in and trying to rush your content in 30, 40 minutes when you were struggling with sharing screens and just hold on a minute and trying to upload your PowerPoint, which half the time wasn't working. And so I thought the school, that fundamental change the school made was really important to sort of empower us and to enable us to keep delivering content. So we responded reasonably well from that point of view. We tried to keep as much of the timetable going as we could. In full knowledge that not everybody on the other side of the computer screen was engaging. But you sort of felt an obligation to do your job and try and deliver your content. And fundamentally, I actually believe we did quite a good job here, yeah.
Anything you feel could have been done better?
I think, look, what could have been done better is the preparation, in the sense that we literally were underskilled, and all of us were underskilled, and we tried to adapt quickly. But as you know, like, some of us are sort of technophobes. Some of us are technological dinosaurs. We've been doing the same thing for a long time, and we just didn't have the skill sets. And it's interesting, since we've gone back into full teaching in front of classes, you'd wonder, if it were to happen tomorrow, would we be in the same place again? Because when you don't use skills, you literally go straight back to not knowing them almost. So you have to relearn. And it's a sort of an interesting question. Like, what could we have done better? Could we have been more prepared? Could we have been more upskilled? Should we have been able to use digital media better? Absolutely. If it happened tomorrow, would we be better prepared? I'm not 100% sure we would.
What about for kids coming back to school? Because we already talked about what it was like not being in school. You know, when I came back, it felt kind of weird, you know, because, like, I never really finished primary school. So it kind of felt like I was supposed to be back in my primary school, and then sitting there for like 6.5 hours a day. Like, do you think that it's became much harder for people to be able to, like, sit and go to school when they've been not doing that for almost a year, pretty much?
God, that's a great question, Ben. To be honest with you, I think it had an incredible impact across the different age grades within the school. Like, as you say, the first year is just lost. Their introduction to school, they lost their grounding, they lost their connection, their attachment, which is so important as a foundation when they come into the school. That sense of belonging, and that just disappears. They didn't get to participate in the sports where they break down relationship barriers and make friends. Our third years don't get to do their sort of practice exam, their junior cert, in which we put so much store. And then for the older guys, like, you've got guys preparing for a leaving cert that may or may not happen. And that created an enormous amount of stress for those guys. So at every level, I think that return to school was very important, because I do believe school is fundamentally, while it's, as I said, it's an unnatural place to be, I think in terms of development across all aspects of yourself, like, it's a huge contributor. So I think for everybody it was difficult. You know, I particularly think for sort of guys around second year and fourth year, that their journey through school, I think, was elongated by COVID. I think that I have a daughter doing her leaving cert, and she's fed up, like, and she's a good worker, but she feels she's been there forever, you know, and it's just has been never ending. I don't think that gap in the middle helped. You know, so it's sort of a really, really difficult challenge to come back and sort of get back into the idea of work and personal discipline, because that all went out the window for a lot of guys, as you know yourself.
Yeah, it's funny that you said that, you know, felt like she's been in school forever. For me, it's the opposite. It feels like school's going by much faster now. And do you think that overall the kids have adapted to the situation? Like, or would you say that we're still feeling the effects?
Yeah, look, I think that people are brilliant. I think we're incredibly adaptable. And I think all from the time you were a young child, you had to adapt to different circumstances. And we tend to just get on with it and move on and move forward and move on to the next challenge. You made an interesting comment at the start. You said the pandemic could have been 10 years ago. Now, I totally agree with you about that. If somebody asked me to put a date on the pandemic, I have no idea when it was. So if you hadn't mentioned the date, I would have struggled with a year. But I do feel, I do feel that everybody has moved on, moved up, got on. But I think they have missed out. And I think they're going to find ways in the future to try and get some of that time back for themselves.
Yeah, we've talked a lot about the academic impact, but what about the emotional impact?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I have a young lad in fourth year here, and as you know, because you were in primary school with him. So one of the things that was fantastic was technology and how it facilitated communication and the maintenance of relationships between kids. Now, it may have been Fortnite for 6 hours a day, but the level of sort of interaction compared to when I was growing up, if you were in a lockdown like that and nobody was allowed outside the door, you literally would have been bored to death. There's only so many books you can read and there's only so many songs you can play on your guitar. But that level of human contact, and so technology actually facilitated that brilliantly. So I thought emotionally that certainly from my perspective that my son and my daughter and their friends actually were able to maintain contact and communication, which I thought was a hugely valuable tool in the middle of what was otherwise quite a desolate period of time.
Well, I mean, obviously technology was pretty key to people being able to adapt, but do you think that maybe there's also the other end of things? Because if you think about it, like, technology is a pretty addictive thing, and like, that's not a new thing, but I feel that when you're in a circumstance in which you can't go to your friends' house, you can't hang out with people. Because I was very careful when it came to the COVID restrictions, because my grandfather was quite sick at the time and we wanted to be able to visit him, but we didn't want to put him at risk. So we were very cautious. And the thing about in that kind of environment where you're very, very restricted, it's very easy to turn to kind of instant gratification with technology and stuff like that. So do you think that maybe, I suppose the negative aspect of that is that now people, teenagers, could be getting even more addicted because they got so used to that in that time frame as their way of coping, if you know what I mean.
Okay, so we're sort of at glass half full, half empty point here, because I totally agree with the idea behind what you're saying. But I wondered, did teenagers get technologied out? And like, one of the things that I've noticed is that every opportunity now that my kids have to actually go out and do something that maybe before they would have said, oh no, I won't, they're sort of, they're more likely to go and do it because of what they missed out on. I don't know, do you know what I mean by that? Like, and so instead of saying, no, I don't want to do that, I don't want to do that, I think that COVID, in a way, it probably was for all of us, not just kids. It gave us a greater appreciation of the simple things, you know, of going out to a beach, going for a walk, you know. It gave us that time. And also what we missed, like, we miss sport, we miss people, we miss contact, you know. So it's sort of, my own sort of feeling is that maybe it's opened people's eyes to the fact that, you know, the world is sort of, in general, where we live, we're fortunate that there's not a lot going on in our world, that we have opportunity to actually engage, you know. And that's more fun than sitting in front of a computer screen, because that was sort of massively forced upon us for a 2 year period, and maybe we just got technologied out a little bit. But that's the half empty, half full. I fully appreciate what you're saying, that we could also have damage done by people just being totally addicted, not wanting to break out and engage now.
You highlight a lot of the individual kind of impacts for the different school years, not just in Prez, but I guess in general. So if we were to talk about the 6 years, for example, now the thing about the 6 years is they were in second year, right? Now, I don't know how it is for other people, because obviously my first year was a weird first year, you know, after COVID. But I feel that second year, for the most part, is kind of when you're more getting used to being in secondary school, you know what I mean? So do you think that for the 6 years to have been at that stage where they just made that adjustment, only to suddenly to make an even, maybe even a bigger adjustment, and now seeing as they're in the last year of school, of their like formal education, I mean, obviously there's college, but college is different from school. Do you think that maybe they're more resistant to the idea of leaving school than they would be before?
Absolutely, 100% not. I think that school has its time, and each student, male, female, every school all over the world, with the obvious odd exception, once they get to sixth year and they see that end line in sight, sixth year is done. They're schooled out. They can't wait for it to end. They can't wait for it to finish. And they can sense the next chapter in their lives opening up already. And if anything, what we get now at this time is we get that frustration of, will this ever end? You know, obviously that big, huge problem of the Leaving Cert at the end of it, which brings all those pressures with it as well. And that sort of, there's a partial excitement always for these guys of, this is nearly done. I've made it. I've achieved it. And I can't wait to go into the next part of my life where I'm an adult. I'm grown up. I'm free. I'm making my own decisions. I'm not told when to get up, what to do, where to go. And they're ready for that. They're 18, 19 years of age and they're ready to go and live their lives. So I honestly, Ben, don't believe that that they're in trepidation. They're nervous like everybody else going into anything new. But I think they're excited. I would hope they're excited because that's the next step in their lives and it's to be looked forward to.
What about the next stage? Like, do you think that maybe... Now, I don't want to sound like the prophet of doom here because I'm trying to keep this even... But taking into account the fact that we were in that isolated kind of period, I know we did stay connected, but do you think that maybe that on some level, at least, has affected kind of basic social interaction? And do you think that that might negatively impact people when they do go on to have jobs in the workplace, when they leave school and everything?
Yeah, I mean, you can't discount it as a reasonable theory. You know, you can't discount it. I just feel that people came out with a hunger to interact when COVID finished. And I think they made up for last time quite quickly. And they wanted to get back into the social scene. The restaurants filled up, the bars filled up, the sports pitches filled up very, very fast, you know. And I think people were hungry for human contact. And I think maybe that bit has been got over, you know. And I think there's been some very interesting things have emerged out of it, like this, even this partial working from home that people are doing now. And also finding... some people loving it and some people saying, no, I actually want to be in the office. I want to be interacting with people. I actually want to meet people because that's the fun of work, you know, is the interacting with people. So I can understand where your question's coming from. And, but I wouldn't actually be worried from that point of view. I think people need people and I think they realize that themselves.
Yeah, that's interesting. You talked about how you felt that since COVID, for all it was, you know, it was like a moment in history, kind of, that you thought that people were going to look back and think, well, that was like that, that was that for them, you know, that was what history was like for people growing up in the 2020s. Now, I know this is kind of a difficult question, but suppose there was like an alternate reality where COVID-19 didn't happen. And suppose you were to be a historian and you were to look at these two different worlds and you were to kind of accelerate it a bit to kind of the later stages of kind of both of these. Do you think that COVID-19 would almost be unnoticeable, that it wouldn't like matter if it happened or not, that we're just going to forget about it? Or do you think that is still going to be something that impacts for us for
next year? That's a great question. Look, except for the tragic loss of life, which touched a lot of people very closely and very deeply, and those people will forever be affected by the losses that they had in COVID, I think that you're right. I think that you'd look back and say this was a minor hiccup, you know, that in the context of overall history was an interesting side note, but did it have any long-term major impact on life and the world and how we live and the way we live? I'm not sure it did.
All right.
I'm not sure it did.
Thanks a lot for that, sir. And thanks to all of our listeners for listening with Heroes today.
Thanks very much, Ben.
That really brings back lots of memories from lockdown and online school especially. Thanks again to Mr. Scott and Ben for putting together that piece on COVID.
Those months at home in first year felt like they'd never end. It's hard to believe that was almost 4 years ago. Leaving COVID in the past, we now have another radio drama as the first one went so well. I wonder what Tadhg, Ronan and John will bring to the podcast this time. I think with Cillian Murphy's amazing Oscar success, there's no surprise that it's Oppenheimer inspired.
Can't wait to hear this one. Let's find out. Roll it.
The apologies, Dr. Roberts. The General is here for an update on Project Nematode. The man is quite impatient and terribly bigoted against me.
Oh, alright. Thanks for telling me, Dr. Bobrov. I'll be out in a moment, just gotta get my notes together.
Of course, Doctor. Yeesh, long night. Your eyes have bags. It's like you've had a hell of a night.
Yeah, I've just been trying to verify the math for hours. But something just doesn't make sense. I feel though I have the strangest sense of deja vu.
Nothing but your brain confused. What did you find, Doctor?
The intensity of the fuel does not equal to the crystallization percentage of the verps. I smell a meltdown. If this is true, we might make an explosion large enough to kill everyone on the base.
Let me see.
Here you go. Do you see any problems?
I see the problem. The half-life of the V-fuel is much too short to damage the verps. It will decay before the silica is significantly crystallized. You wrote this under the assumption you were using uranium.
Oh, of course. Seems like nothing then. Thank you, Dr. Bobrov.
No problem. Now, General, come on.
Oh, of course, Doctor. Is this your first time meeting the General?
Yes, he's a nasty man. We shouldn't keep him waiting.
Don't worry, he'll warm up to you.
I hope so. If conditions continue like this, I might as well just go back to the Soviet Union.
I wouldn't blame you. It's hell in here. I miss New York.
I agree. I prefer it there than here. Now come on, let's not keep this General waiting.
General?
General?
All right, Dr. Ruski, tell me what the Energy Department of Everglades research is up to.
Yes, General. We've gotten to the final stage before large-scale testing.
Never send a tank here to explain Americans' work. I want specifics. What's it powered by? How heavy is the prototype? How much power does it produce? Does it have military applications? How much freedom can it export to your homeland, you liberty-hating red?
You'll find that all in the brief. Now, we have a demonstration prepared if you'd like to come with us.
This all seems mighty impressive, Doctor. Let's see if your prototype works now.
Here it is, General.
Mother of God. What kind of generator do you build here, boys?
It's a reactor, General. Big difference.
Don't you correct me, Red. But yes, reactor. Right. How does it work, Dr. Roberts?
We place a piece of recently exposed V-fuel on the platform in the middle of the reactor. Then we use the V-fuel ionizing radiation protections, or VERPs, to harness the decay of the radiation.
Sweet Jesus Christ, I didn't know you spoke Russian. English, please.
It's a big reactor that produces energy from the heat.
Pre-activation checks are all green. We're set to insert the payload.
All right, if you have any other questions, General, it's in the briefing.
Let's see the fireworks then, boys.
If we see anything sparking or flying off, then something is deeply wrong with the prototype.
Begin in phase one.
Any good. Why does chest chamber look like that?
Blue shift. But I'm not sure it should be that intense.
Well, that's fine. We've seen worse with U-235. Initiating phase two.
Spark's always a good sign. Should be that bright, though.
No, something's wrong. Dr. Bobrov?
Yes, the decay is outlasting our predictions, it seems. Crystallization is at 66%. I'd advise activating phase 3.
But didn't you hear the man? Activate phase 3, goddammit.
Activate in phase 3.
No!
Hey, Alex, I said not to activate it. Damn it.
Damn it, this has to be sabotage. Right, I'm getting out here. But why isn't this door opening?
Sergey, I'll be critical.
Super critical. Forget about meltdown. We're getting temporal interference. Survival chance, 0%.
Open the damn door. Help. Help me. This mad Russian dog is going to kill us all.
Dear God, hang on. Holy cow. I'm still alive. Yes! Thank you, God! Damn. Damn, but... Where am I? Oh, sir... Wait. You're not Sergey. Who are you?
Well done, Dr. Roberts. I'm von Weber. Perchance you've heard of me from those charred books you found in Berlin.
I have. Project Innovation, the original V-Fuel. How are you here? You died in 45, didn't you?
Perhaps. Or maybe something else occurred. Something far beyond your comprehension. But alas, this is not the time for introductions. You're a killer, Dr. Roberts.
Oh, you're serious. What do you mean, Doctor?
Please, call me Jürgen. This chain of events you have set off, it will cause the end of the world. I've seen it.
Nah, you're lying. What the hell are you talking about? Are you funking in the head or something?
Let me show you what terrible destruction you will wreak.
Where are we now?
Shh. Be quiet. This is a funeral. Have some respect. It's yours, after all. See those three lined coffins?
Yeah.
Dr. Bovrov and the General is in those coffins. You were supposed to be too, but they never found your body. You and your colleagues are buried on 18th of March, 1952. Your wife is told the truth, but it won't keep it hidden. She never remarries.
Oh. Dear God, poor Susan. I failed to think about her from all this. Well, at least we'd be the last to die from such a thing. Right?
Apologies. The naivety is killing me. No. Your death would inspire other scientists at Northern Lights to create a stable V-fuel reactor. And it would become the model for everything.
Oh, good. And they used our inventions to save the world from the energy crisis?
Oh, not at all, actually. It was only used for military applications. Tanks, suits of armor, rifles, and... Well, let me show you.
I don't like how you trailed off there, Jürgen. Oh! New York. Home. That's the Empire State Building. And there's Broadway. Why are we here?
This will be the last of my lessons of the future. You see, V-fuel became quite scarce. And when the Soviet Union ran out of it, they invaded California and took their supply. July 4th, 1987. Lovely day for a picnic, yeah?
Yeah. The 4th of July was always lovely for a picnic. Used to bring the wife and the kid with me.
Oh my, you have no idea.
No idea about what... Hey, where'd you get that radio from?
News updates.
This is an emergency broadcast for residents of New York, New Jersey, Delaware, Pennsylvania. As of 6 p.m. EST, there have been confirmed nuclear strikes on Detroit, Boston, Las Vegas, Kansas City, Omaha, and Chicago. If you are hearing this broadcast, your area is under threat from a similar strike. Please take shelter and stay tuned for updates on the situation. If you are in a tall building, head to the middle floor and stay away from windows. Damn it, turn that thing off! What sick joke is this? They'd never... Oh no. No. Why is it purple?
Because they put your reactor on the missiles and use their warheads.
Ah! Damn you! Damn this whole blasted world! No, this can't happen. Send me back.
Oh, you mean it? Really? You want to go back through the day of the experiment?
Yes, I can fix this. I can fix this messed up world. Make this never happen. You're in charge of time or something. Send me back now.
If you insist, I'll send you back, Dr. Roberts. Well. It was an honor meeting the man who made my vision real.
Apologies, Dr. Roberts. The General is here for our update on Project Nematode. The man is quite impatient and terribly bigoted towards me.
What an excellent way to end, and with something so original. How did you find it?
I love those guys. Their accents are just incredible. I really, really hope they come back for part two.
Oh, same here. But for now, that's all we have time for on episode 3 of PBC Podcast. A huge thanks to all our guests who took the time out of their days to come and speak to us here in Prez.
A big thanks to PBC management for their continued support, as well to all of our teachers who allowed us off time to record when needed. Our thanks also to Elaine Smith for sound production, and finally to Mr. Aino Olinchig, who produces our show.
My name is Stephen Delaney.
And my name is Oisin Tobin. And this has been episode 3 of PBC Podcast.